Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from The Week magazine, dated April 27th, 2012. And now we begin with the main stories section from The Week magazine. Our first item is entitled, The GOP Blocks Obama's Buffett Rule. What happened? The debate over higher taxes for the wealthy returned to center stage this past week as Senate Republicans filibustered a millionaire's tax championed by President Obama. The Buffett rule, named after billionaire investor Warren Buffett, who famously complained that he paid a lower tax rate than his secretary, would impose a minimum 30% tax rate on anyone earning $1 million or more per year. Even though polls showed that the bill enjoyed support from 72% of the public, Senate Democrats were unable to get the 60-vote majority required to break a filibuster, with senators voting 51 to 45 to proceed. Senate Republicans derided the Buffett rule as an election year gimmick, but Obama said the bill would be the first to bringing some basic fairness to the tax code, adding that it was just plain wrong that millions of middle-class Americans pay a higher share of their income in taxes than some millionaires and billionaires. House Republicans countered with their own election year tax proposal. The Small Business Tax Cut Act, which would cut taxes by 20% for businesses with fewer than 500 employees. The bill proposed by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the Republican from Virginia, was expected to pass the Republican-controlled House, but to die in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Since the other side will not join us in an honest tax reform discussion, said Cantor, we believe that right now it is urgent that we help our job creators. Now here's what the editorial said. The Buffett rule is a non-solution to a non-problem, said NationalReview.com. Wealthy Americans already pay the bulk of federal income taxes. Only 10% of millionaires are taxed at a rate of 24% or less. Most of them retirees and professional investors who get most of their incomes from capital gains rather than salaries. This supposed fix would only raise $5 billion a year anyway, said the Wall Street Journal, or less than 0.5% of this year's budget deficit. For all Obama's talk of fairness, this gimmicky addition to the tax code would serve only to advance his goal of spreading the wealth, while effectively doubling the capital gains tax and discouraging investment and job creation. The Buffett rule makes sense as a simple matter of fairness, said the Washington Post, but even ending the Bush tax cuts on those making more than $250,000, another Obama goal, would not fund the country's burgeoning entitlement costs while reducing the annual $1 trillion deficit. Sadly, Obama would prefer to rail against millionaires who fail to pay their fair share than to say that the pain will have to be more widely shared. Now here's what the columnist said. The Buffett rule isn't tax policy, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. It's a naked attempt to channel the sentiment underlying Occupy Wall Street and pit the 99% against the 1%. The fact that Obama will keep talking about higher taxes on the rich has nothing to do with debt reduction and everything to do with re-election. True enough, said Nancy Cook in NationalJournal.com, and it just might work. The Republicans' adamant opposition to raising taxes on millionaires will give Obama and the Democrats a clear, distinct talking point for the campaign trail, that they alone are the defenders of the middle class, standing up for fairness and civic responsibility. The Buffett rule is indeed a political ploy, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, but that doesn't make it wrong or even cynical. It's a symbolic way of exposing Republican extremism, the party's nutty opposition to any higher taxes on the rich. Republicans aren't alone in their irrational and anti-tax orthodoxy, said Ezra Klein in Bloomberg.com. Obama and the Democrats won't consider raising taxes on anyone except the 2% of Americans earning $250,000 or more. But that will only raise $1.5 trillion over 10 years, not nearly enough to pay for the social welfare state that they say they support. With the country facing mounting costs and growing debt, the only responsible way forward is comprehensive tax reform, with broadly distributed increases. Sadly, both parties would rather pander to their respective constituencies with ridiculous tax pledges. The next item from the main story section this week is turmoil in Afghanistan. In a dramatic 18-hour series of coordinated attacks, militants blasted grenades and gunfire at foreign sites in Kabul this past week, including NATO headquarters and the U.S. Embassy, while others struck airfields and police stations in Afghanistan's eastern provinces. The Taliban claimed responsibility, but at least one of the four insurgents captured said he was with the Haqqani Network, a military group linked to al-Qaeda. U.S. General John Allen, the NATO commander in Afghanistan, joined Afghan President Hamid Karzai in praising Afghan forces for their effectiveness in repulsing the attacks. Ties between the two allies faced a new strain, however, after the Los Angeles Times published photos this past week showing American troops posing in 2010 with body parts of dead Afghan fighters. These images by no means represent the values or professionalism of the vast majority of U.S. troops serving in Afghanistan today, said Pentagon spokesman George Little. This week's attack should make the Obama administration rethink its exit plan, said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. If the Taliban can penetrate Kabul, which has been advertised as Afghanistan's safest city, when 130,000 NATO troops are still in the country, then they will surely be able to take it over once foreign troops leave. Yet Obama continues to insist on his arbitrary timetable for a total pullout of by 2014, starting with 23,000 troops this September. The U.S. risks betraying the Afghan people and the Afghan women in particular if it simply abandons them again to the barbaric regime it toppled 10 years ago. These attacks are hardly evidence of a resurgent Taliban, said Mark Thompson in Time.com. In fact, they were pretty Bush League. 8 Afghan police and 3 civilians lost their lives, while 36 militants were killed. Still, the political ramifications could prove far greater. There's an eerie parallel here with the Viet Cong's 1968 Tet Offensive, which changed little on the ground but belied claims of American progress and turned the American public against the Vietnam War. This week's fighting reveals little about whether the U.S. is winning or losing in Afghanistan, said Stephen Walt in foreignpolicy.com. We can't let it distract us from the larger strategic issue Washington faces, whether trying to win is worth the cost. On that point, unfortunately, there's still no easy answer. The next item from the main story section of the week, a Secret Service sex scandal. The U.S. Secret Service was rocked by the biggest scandal in its history last week after 11 agents assigned to President Obama were placed under investigation for allegedly hiring prostitutes. The men were preparing for Obama's visit to Cartagena, Colombia, for the Summit of the Americas. Investigators said that the agents and 10 military personnel partied at a bordello before bringing at least 20 women back to their hotel. Local police were summoned the next morning after one woman refused to leave an agent's hotel room, claiming that she was owed money. The agent paid up, but the incident was reported to the U.S. Embassy. Senator Susan Collins, who sits on the House Homeland Security Committee, said she was pressing the Secret Service to determine whether the president's security had been jeopardized. How could elite agents be so stupid, asked the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. By acting like college freshmen on a fraternity road trip, these men open themselves to blackmail and risk the president's safety. It's unlikely that this was the first such episode. Investigators urgently need to establish how often such behavior has occurred and how much higher-ups knew about it. Let's curb the outrage, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. Obviously, you don't want people who are supposed to be guarding the president wandering off to pick up prostitutes. But this cavorting took place 2 days before Obama's arrival in a country where prostitution is legal. Naughty behavior by 11 guys in dark glasses isn't something America should lose sleep over. Nor should we be shocked, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. After all, the U.S. is the home of Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, and Snooki. Debauchery is an American specialty. At the very least, this scandal should help refute claims that government employees are out of touch with ordinary Americans. As it turns out, some federal workers reflect our culture all too well. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week, the mommy wars. Does Ann Romney work? You can't blame Republicans for wanting to change the subject, said The Nation in an editorial. From the point of view of female voters, it's been a disastrous couple of months for the GOP. As conservatives attacked contraception coverage and health plans, right-wing icon Rush Limbaugh engaged in the slut-shaming of Sandra Fluke, and Mitt Romney vowed to defund Planned Parenthood. Just as the Democratic narrative of a Republican war on women was taking root, said Jane Meyer in NewYorker.com, along came Hillary Rosen. A CNN pundit and longtime Democratic Party advisor, Rosen last week belittled Romney's statement that he was getting advice on women's economic issues from his wife. Mother of five, Ann Romney, said Rosen, has never worked a day in her life. That was all it took. Just as when Hillary Clinton said she could have just stayed home and baked cookies in 1992, gleeful Republicans claimed that Rosen had let slip the Democrats' contempt for women who choose homemaking over a career. Rosen quickly apologized as President Obama and the Democrats scrambled to disown her. But it was too late. The mommy wars had been reignited. Rosen meant exactly what she said, John Giordano said in Spectator.org. Her condescending put-down of Ann Romney was part and parcel of a long-standing effort by many on the left to denigrate and demean women who choose not to work outside the home. The rearing of children is the most important job in the world, said Suzanne Venker in NationalReview.com, whereas the chronic absence of moms from the home is at the core of countless social ills. But liberals scorn the traditional family, viewing it as a mortal threat to their vision of a gender-neutral utopia where kids are raised by nannies and daycare centers. Rosen shouldn't have used such dismissive language, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com. As the mother of two herself, she should know only too well that staying at home with the kids is the very definition of hard work. But Rosen's underlying point was correct. In a clumsy effort to woo female voters, Mitt Romney asserted that he relies on Ann to take the pulse of working women in this struggling economy. The Romneys are worth about 250 $50 million and own several lavish homes, and Ann drives two Cadillac SUVs. She raised her five sons without ever having to worry about money. You don't have to be a combatant on either side of the mommy wars to recognize that Ann Romney's privileged life experience is not typical. And Romney fired back at Rosen, said Tara McGinnis in Politico.com, saying that we need to respect choices that women make. She's right. But 73% of American moms now work, and what Mrs. Romney fails to understand is that for most American mothers, the economic reality of their lives does not leave a lot of choices. We work because we have to. The whole debate is insulting to women, said Gina McGregor in WashingtonPost.com. All the hyperbole and finger-pointing makes it clear that both Democrats and Republicans still view women as a voting bloc of hormonal simpletons who decide who they're going to vote for based on what the pundits and the spokespeople say. What are the candidates' policies on child care options, maternity leave, and equal pay laws? Women deserve a substantive discussion of the issues that affect them, not this patronizing theater of phony wars and fake outrage. Yes, as Ann Romney and Michelle Obama both declared last week, every woman deserves respect. But you know what? So does every voter. And now we'll turn from the main story section of the Week magazine to the very popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for doing your homework after Dmitry Kryakov, a UC San Diego physicist, successfully fought a $400 traffic ticket by submitting a four-page paper of equations and graphs titled The Proof of Innocence, arguing that the police officer was fooled by an optical illusion. It was a good week for burglars after a poll found that 27% of Americans who keep sizable amounts of cash in their homes hide it in their freezers. 11% prefer to stash the cash under their mattresses. And it was a good week for online journalism after the Huffington Post won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. The award honors veteran journalist David Wood's 10-part series on the struggles of injured American soldiers returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was a bad week for fiction writers after no fiction Pulitzer was awarded this year for the first time in 35 years because none of the three finalists received a majority of votes from the judges. It was a bad week for Ted Nugent, the rock and roller turned gun enthusiast who said during the NRA convention that President Obama is like a coyote that deserves to be shot, adding that if Obama is reelected, I will either be dead or in jail next year. The Secret Service said it would be asking Nugent for a clarification. And it was a bad week for Mohammad Ashan, a Taliban commander who saw his face on a wanted poster and asked Afghan security forces for the $100 finder's fee. Yes, that's me, he said. Can I get my reward now? He was arrested with no finder's fee. And now we'll be reading from the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Sarandon's Adventures in Singlehood. Susan Sarandon is still adapting to single life, said Chrissy Eiley in the Daily Telegraph. She broke up with partner Tim Robbins in 2009, 21 years after they got together on the set of Bull Durham. Somebody said, does it get easier? I don't think it gets easier, but it gets better, says the 65-year-old actress who has two sons with Robbins. It's a little scary, but I feel like I'm living an authentic life right now. I feel happy and I have more options because the kids are older and my situation being what it is. A couple of years ago, she opened a ping pong club in New York called Spin. The game appeals to her because girls can beat boys, and older women can beat younger women. Gossip columns are filled with talk that Sarandon is dating her partner in the venture, 34-year-old Jonathan Bricklin. "Yeah," she says in a kind of pleased-with-herself growl. "Are the rumors true? I'd say we are collaborators in a lot of different areas. We have a lot of projects in different areas." Does she like him? "He's a great guy, but I hate that expression, dating. Is that a polite way of admitting she's sleeping with Bricklin?" Sarandon smiles, all coy. "Don't you like the word collaborating?" Our next item is entitled, "The Sailor Who Kissed the Iron Lady." Mick Fellows once enjoyed a brief encounter with Margaret Thatcher, said Jack Malvern in the Times in the United Kingdom. During the Falkland Wars, the British Royal Navy diver was ordered to deal with an unexploded bomb that had hit the HMS Antrim. With the ship coming under attack from the air, he called colleagues in the UK for help. All they could suggest was that he keep the bomb level and perhaps notify his wife about the situation. Fellows unleashed a torrent of profanities. "What I didn't know was that this conversation was being broadcast to the cabinet room, where Margaret Thatcher was listening," he recalls. Later, having succeeded in saving the ship, he was invited to meet the Prime Minister. She said she wanted to meet the angry man. "She told me she had heard a lot of swearing working in her father's grocery, but said, 'You taught me some words I didn't know.'" Thatcher showed him a map of the Falklands, and that was under the cabinet room table, and asked him to point out where the Antrim had been. "And then," he says, "the Prime Minister kissed me on the lips. I stood up so quick I hit my head on the table. She said to me, 'Ever since I was a girl, I've always wanted to kiss a sailor.'" And the next item in the People section, Statham's rogue trading. "Jason Statham isn't ashamed of his street hawker past," said Ivan Solitaroff in Details. "Growing up in a poor South London neighborhood, Statham was schooled by his father in the art of selling counterfeit jewelry. We'd set up shop, mock auctions, the run out," says the action movie star. "These are all words and names describing the way people get ripped off. The ersatz goods trade paid well. Man, we was doing £1,000, £2,000, about $1,600 to $3,200, selling stuff you'd buy for maybe 60 pence. That is pure profit. He doesn't feel any pity for his old customers. It's people's own greed that allows them to get ripped off. If your intuition served you at all, you'd never be in that shop," he says. "And we never said, 'That's gold, that's Cartier.' We just never let them ask. If they insisted, you'd say, 'I'll get a price in a minute.' My mother waited 9 months for me. You can wait another minute, can't you?" Statham doesn't see much difference between his old career and his new one in Hollywood. "So much of this industry is bull. But I do it for a living. I see it before it enters the room." And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the briefing section. This week it's entitled, "The Not-So-Golden Years." Millions of Americans aren't saving nearly enough in their 401k plans for retirement. What does their future hold? What's the case against 401ks? They're failing to provide enough money for older Americans. As the country's principal way to save for retirement, the 401k program allows employees to set aside a portion of their paychecks, often supplemented with matching funds from their employers, and to defer taxes until they start withdrawing funds. But most of the nearly 80 million baby boomers, the oldest of whom are just now starting to turn 65, haven't put aside nearly enough, and are in danger of exhausting their savings within a few years of retirement. "It has already become clear," said Karen Friedman of the Pension Rights Center in Washington, D.C., "that 401ks have failed millions of Americans." How much have people put aside? The average balance in all 50 million 401k accounts is just over $60,000, according to the Employee Benefit Research Institute. Even people within 10 years of retirement have saved an average of only $78,000, and more than a third of them have less than $25,000. More than half of U.S. workers have no retirement plan at all. With Social Security averaging $14,780 a year for individuals and $22,000 for couples, many Americans will exhaust their savings in just a few years. Since millions of boomers are likely to live into their 70s and 80s, the country is headed toward a major crisis. It looks like most middle-class Americans will become poor or near-poor retirees, said Teresa Ghilarducci, a retirement specialist at the New School in New York. Why are balances so low? The financial crisis is partly to blame. It knocked $1.6 trillion, or about a third of the total value, off the nation's 401k accounts. But the larger truth is that most Americans do a poor job of anticipating the future and saving money. People don't seem to grasp that the pensions their parents' generation enjoyed have been almost entirely supplanted by 401ks, leaving them largely on their own to fund the final stage of their lives. In one recent survey, 43% of workers between the ages of 45 and 54 said they weren't currently saving for retirement at all. Very few 401k participants contribute the annual maximum of $17,000, and people tend to stop funding their retirement or even borrow against balances when they change jobs or have debts to pay. Most 401k account holders have little knowledge of how to manage stocks and bonds over decades to produce the best returns. How did we come to depend so much on 401ks? The Revenue Act of 1978 created the 401ks. Their name comes from the relevant subsection of the Internal Revenue Code as a way for corporate executives to supplement their traditional pensions with extra cash. But when employers realized that they could use them to slash their pension costs by shifting the burden of retirement funding to employees, they adopted 401ks in droves. In 1980, 60% of private sector workers with retirement plans had employer-paid pensions. By 2006, only 10% did, and 66% had 401ks. The chief selling points of 401ks are that they allow workers to take savings with them if they change jobs and to decide how and how much to invest in their retirement. But even automatic enrollment and free financial counseling haven't compelled people to save enough. How much should people really be saving? More, far more. Many people are still assuming that they'll get 10% annual returns on their savings. The stock market volatility of recent years would suggest that's overly optimistic. To provide for a retirement lasting 20 years, Vanguard, a major 401k administrator, now recommends that an annual contribution of 12 to 15% of income, including an employer's match. But even that is only enough if you start young. A worker who starts contributing at 35 and earns $43,000 has to sock away more than $10,000 a year, the Center for Retirement Research estimates, to maintain his or her lifestyle after retiring at 65. The Employee Benefit Research Institute says the average earner will need $900,000 upon retirement, a sum few people are on target to reach. So how will boomers cope? Many will just have to keep working. They'll also have to move into cheaper housing, cut back on travel, and live with far greater financial uncertainty. The baby boomers will be the first generation that will do worse in retirement than their parents, said the New School's Ghilarducci. That's not news to Gloria Moss, now over 60. She has been saving in a 401k since 1985, but has only half what she needs. I'm going to probably have to work considerably longer than I anticipated, she said. Financial advisor Paul Merritt says most of his retirement age clients reach the same conclusion after taking a hard look at the numbers. The discussion turns out to be, what kind of part-time work do you want to do after you retire? And the footnote to today's article entitled The Not-So-Golden Years is called Skimming Off the Top. Future retirees don't have only themselves to blame for paltry retirement savings. Excessive management fees also play a role. Every day, Americans pay about $164 million in 401k fees to the financial industry. There are enormous dollar amounts involved, said Frank Carullo, a former plan consultant. Employees are getting ripped off. Fees vary from plan to plan, and they can run anywhere from 0.5 to 2% of assets per year. An extra 0.5% annual fee can cut an employee's savings by 10% by the time he's 65, according to Vanguard. Most 401k fees have long been hidden, but under new rules taking effect this summer, plan providers have to give detailed breakdowns of all the fees to employers, who in turn have to inform employees. Savers can only hope that transparency kicks off competition that will lower those fees. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. as determined by the Week. We'll begin this week with one entitled, Hillary Has a Real Shot in 2016 by Paul Begala, thedailybeast.com. Will Hillary Clinton run for president in 2016, asked Paul Begala. Despite her insistence that she's tired and ready to retire from public life, speculation about the Secretary of State's political future is intensifying. With a 69% approval rating, she is the most popular political figure in the country. Her expressed disinterest in a political future has only made people like her more. Paradoxically, the less you yearn for the presidency, the more the country yearns for you. Hillary has grown enormously since her failed presidential run in 2008, when her campaign was riven with rivalries. At Foggy Bottom, Clinton has avoided even a hint of conflict with her old rival-turned-boss, Barack Obama, or other cabinet officials. Hillary has managed to be strong, forceful, independent, and yet completely loyal. She's also acquired deep foreign policy knowledge while jetting all over the globe, skillfully navigating the troubled waters of Iran's nuclear ambitions, North Korea's saber-rattling, and the fallout of the Arab Spring. Whether she chooses to run in 4 years will be up to her, but who's more qualified? The next column is The View Through the Partisan Lens by Chris Mooney in the Washington Post. Why can't liberals and conservatives agree about anything, even the facts? Asked Chris Mooney. New research in psychology has found that liberals and conservatives process information in divergent ways, and thus can come to conflicting conclusions about, say, global warming or whether stimulus programs create jobs. On tests of personality, liberals tend to be more open to change and new ideas. They crave novelty and welcome new vacation spots, restaurants, and music. Conservatives tend to be conscientious and value order, structure, and consistency. Both personality types have value, but can also lead to spasms of irrationality. Liberals, for example, seized on the bogus theory that childhood vaccines cause autism because it was a trendy idea about big bad drug companies harming defenseless children. Conservatives, meanwhile, have a strong need for cognitive closure, causing them to dismiss any evidence of global warming, evolution, or anything else that threatens their beliefs. The result, the public discourse in which there is no truth that we all agree upon, and bitter disagreement without end. And the next column is entitled The Slippery Slope of Cohabitation by Meg Jay in the New York Times. Most young couples now live together as a safe first step before marriage, said Meg Jay, but research shows that cohabitation is anything but safe. It makes couples less likely to be satisfied with their marriages and more likely to divorce later. In my psychology practice, I have seen many couples move from dating to sleeping over to cohabitation along a gradual slope, unmarked by rings or ceremonies or sometimes even a conversation. Without saying so, women usually think of living together as a step toward marriage, whereas men tend to view it as a way of auditioning their partners while postponing commitment. As years slide by, the two people find that despite the trial nature of their relationship, they have become bound together by shared leases, wireless contracts, furniture, pets, and friends. Those who work up the courage to split find that the setup and switching costs are nearly as wrenching as a divorce. Others drift into marriage while secretly wondering whether they have consciously chosen their mates. To increase your chance of a satisfying, lasting relationship, it's best to start with "I do" rather than "maybe we will" and "maybe we won't." And now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week to the section called The Last Word. This week, the article is one close to North Carolina. It's called John Edwards in Exile. As his trial begins, the former presidential candidate is a haunted man, says Michael Leahy. He's also scared. Last year, John Edwards sat with a longtime friend in the 10,000-square-foot house that is the centerpiece of his 102-acre Chapel Hill, North Carolina estate. The friend, a New Jersey lawyer named Glenn Bergenfield, who had attended law school with Edwards, was one of the select few members of a diminishing club, those whom the disgraced Edwards wanted to see and those who wanted to see him. Sometimes Bergenfield just listened. Edwards, under criminal indictment, always talked about his children and often of his late wife, Elizabeth. And after a while, he usually got around to the matter of Ryle Hunter, the woman with whom he had an affair and a child. These were the characters of the soap opera that Edwards' life had descended to. The would-be president, the other woman, the love child, the courageous wife, the dying wife. But here in this large, lonesome house, the conversations were intimate and introspective. Edwards sounded utterly befuddled by what he had done, as if he were talking about a stranger. His confusion extended to the latest chapter in the drama, criminal charges alleging that in an effort to conceal his affair during the height of his 2008 presidential campaign, he illegally arranged for secret contributions of about $1 million to take care of Hunter's needs as she prepared to give birth to their daughter, Quinn. He knows he made mistakes, Bergenfield says on the eve of Edwards' trial. But John thinks that the treatment of him is so unflinchingly horrible, and that what he did is not so different from what others did. JFK, Clinton, the whole rogues gallery. We've had this conversation about his situation, and I remember he did compare it to Clinton. He said, "I did a horrendous thing, but I don't know why I'm getting such an unforgiving treatment when you think of what other people have done." The more Edwards talked, the more Bergenfield would do his best to buoy him. He also wanted to lend his support to the two Edwards children living at home, Emma Claire, who is 13, and Jack, who is 11. He is godfather to Jack, as he was to Edwards' oldest son, Wade, who died in a car accident in 1996 and is buried alongside his mother. At times, though, Bergenfield found himself scanning the house, whose every feature owes its existence to the dreams of Elizabeth, with whom Bergenfield's friendship had been even tighter than with Edwards, so close that he had delivered a eulogy at her funeral. "Every floor tile, every post in it, it's her," Bergenfield says, grateful for how the house serves as a bond to his departed friend. But what must it be for Edwards, he wonders. This is where Edward spends most of his time now, preparing for his trial. Being in the house is a reminder of Elizabeth for John, he says, and that means the other things, too. I think it's hard for him to be there without thinking about what a horrible mess this has all been, about all his mistakes and regrets. He has said as much to me. Houses aren't haunted. Men haunt themselves, Bergenfiel knows. There's genuine sadness there that nothing to do with his trial, that has nothing to do with his trial, he says. By design, the house sits back in the thick Carolina woods, too far away to be glimpsed through the trees by motorists on Old Greensboro Road, the public thoroughfare running by the estate. Rural and lightly populated, the area is a good place to get lost. No one close to Edwards disputes the obvious. The unrelenting quiet is an indication of just how far he has fallen. Especially around Chapel Hill and the Edwards's former home in nearby Raleigh, several longtime friends privately say they want nothing to do with him, that they felt personally betrayed by his persistent lies during the period when he desperately sought to cover up his affair. The antipathy toward him around these parts shows no signs of abating. He spends considerably less time in popular Chapel Hill haunts that once in his days as a stunningly successful trial lawyer and overnight political star accorded him golden boy status. 3 years ago, with the scandal at its height, he ate lunch with an elderly couple at crowded Foster's Market, a popular cafe in town where he looked at ease in Bermuda shorts and a T-shirt. As he left, patrons hissed at him. It was more than audible. It was loud, a witness recalls. He kept walking toward the door as if he didn't hear or see anything. He finds less likely refuges now. Over the past couple of years, he has sometimes dropped in at the Wooden Nickel, a working man's bar in nearby sleepy Hillsboro, where the posted rules include not drinking while leaning on the cars outside. Friends think the animosity and pressure contributed to his recent health scare, a heart ailment that necessitated treatment and a short delay in the trial. Edwards' doctor emphasized in a note to the court that his 58-year-old patient needs to avoid stress, but he's doing better, Bergenfield says. Edwards' legal team is led by well-known Washington lawyer Abby Lowell, who assumed control of the defense after a series of other lawyers, including Obama's former White House counsel Gregory Craig, left the case amid rumors that they were unable to secure a plea deal to Edwards' liking. At a hearing in Greensboro on the last Monday in March, the defense reminded observers of a key component of its strategy: destroy the credibility of Andrew Young, Edwards' former personal aide, who is slated to be a key prosecution witness. It was a largely uneventful morning. Edwards had chosen to stay home, and the courtroom crowd was sparse. Afterwards, someone asked another defense attorney, Alan Duncan, about the state of mind of the man on Old Greensboro Road. Duncan inhaled and said tersely, "He's taking care of his children. Thanks, y'all." Edwards' mood, friends note, brightens with the presence of family members and loyalists. Last year, he spent considerable time with his oldest child, Kate, a Harvard Law School graduate, as her wedding approached. When Bergenfield visited, the two men brought Emma Claire and Jack to a packed restaurant for hamburgers. They had to wait for a table. Other diners stared. It was fine, Bergenfield recalls. He ponders whether he has noticed any difference in the way strangers act now around his friend. He's not treated special or different, Bergenfield says. It's fine. Edwards has tried to help Jack's baseball teams in recent years by doing some coaching, Bergenfield says. And last spring, the two men went to watch Emma Claire play in a softball game at the Durham Academy, where she attends school. John was just another parent watching the game, Bergenfield recounts. Afterward, he was just standing there by himself. Emma grabbed his arm and said, "Dad, we gotta get in line and sign up." It was like juice box sign up or something. Every parent had to bring juice boxes. John just got in line. Bergenfield doesn't know everything, he says. He acknowledges that Edwards maintains contact with Hunter for the sake of seeing their daughter, among other things, but adds that he knows little else beyond the fact that she lives in a couple of hours away in North Carolina. Edwards wants to always be there for Quinn, he says. Anything beyond that, I'd be guessing. Asked what accounted for the depth of his friend's fall, Bergenfield says he has yet to understand it. Within our greatest traits are the seeds of our undoing at times, he says. There is a connection between John's great gifts and the great problems he has now. He thought that he could do anything, and some of these things were selfish things. It's hard even for John to make sense of it. To others who have long known Edwards or worked with him, nothing was sudden about his downfall. Several trace their disappointment with him as far back as the aftermath of his winning 1998 Senate campaign. Soon they concluded that he was on a climb that would not include them. In time, the Hunter scandal merely felt to them like the zenith of his trajectory. Some people who knew him told me, "You don't know him well enough," but by then I had drunk the Kool-Aid, remembers Gary Pierce, a longtime North Carolina Democratic consultant and a strategist in Edwards' 98 Senate campaign, who eventually had a falling out with Edwards and Elizabeth. He went too far, too fast. He forgot about North Carolina. We saw each other after the campaign. It was like a month after he'd entered office. He asked, "How do I get on Al Gore's shortlist for vice president in 2000? He had a lot of disappointed supporters here who felt their interests had been totally ignored. They felt betrayed. A key Edwards backer from Raleigh remembers watching when Edwards appeared on ABC in 2008 to claim that Hunter's child could not be his. "I just knew by how he said it that he was lying and that he thought he was going to get away with it," the supporter remembers. "I was furious with him and myself. You don't get to forgive yourself for being duped like that. Redemption now would be a tough row for him to hoe." But the man adds that he has acute scandal fatigue. "Does a sorry person get convicted just because he's a sorry person?" he asks, in explaining why he doesn't want Edwards to be convicted. Supportive of that kind of reasoning, Bergenfield nonetheless has heard the counter-argument that the case is about far more than a cover-up of infidelities, that among other things, Edwards' maneuvering would have left him open to manipulation and bribery by illicit contributors had he reached the White House. Even some of Edwards' sympathizers worry what might happen if jurors reduce the complex legal issues to a single moral question. "If they're looking for someone to pay for this mess, you never know," one says. Bergenfield's hope is that his friend can somehow find his way out of his house and back to what he did best before fame and infamy found him. He's an extraordinarily talented lawyer, and I believe his empathy has always been genuine, he says. The picture of him is mixed. He has a big heart with flaws, but that heart is there. He just wants to do something worthwhile. Bergenfield paused, trying to picture his friend back in a courtroom arguing a case. Something unsettling occurred to him. "I'm just fearful that it might be impossible for people to look at him and see the skilled lawyer anymore," he says slowly. "They might only think of the $400 haircuts and the mistakes in his marriage and not see anything else. So there's uncertainty. The truth is nobody knows what is going to happen to him." And that article was copyrighted in 2012 by the Washington Post and reprinted with permission. Now from the Week magazine, we'll take a look at some articles from the Health and Science section this week. Our first article is entitled "A Link Between Obesity and Autism." Is America's obesity epidemic causing the mysterious surge in autism? A new study shows that obese pregnant women are 60% more likely to give birth to a child with autism than women of a healthy weight, and twice as likely to have a child with some developmental disorder. About a third of American women of reproductive age are now considered obese. Last month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that 1 in 88 children has autism or a related disorder, such as Asperger's syndrome, up from 1 in 110 several years ago. The study doesn't prove a causal connection between obesity and autism, but the fetal brain is susceptible to everything that's happening in the mother's body, study author Irva Hertz-Picata, an epidemiologist at the University of California, Davis, tells the Wall Street Journal. Her theory is that overweight mothers tend to have insulin disorders that can increase inflammation in fetal brain tissue, damaging its ability to take in necessary nutrients and oxygen at key developmental stages. Researchers have established a significant genetic component to autism, but the obesity finding is in line with recent studies pointing to other factors, including older parental age and air pollution. The next article is entitled, Why Homophobes Hate. People who lash out at gay people with anger and hate are often reacting to repressed homosexual tendencies of their own. That's the finding of a new study that suggests that many vocal homophobes protest too much, precisely because deep down they are fearing their own impulses. University of Rochester psychologist Richard Ryan tells LiveScience.com. He and his colleagues asked German and American college students a series of questions to judge their attitudes and those of their parents toward homosexuality. Then they tested the subjects' subconscious attraction to the same sex, in part by asking them to rate the attractiveness of men and women in a series of photos while recording how much time they spent looking at each photo. The researchers found that the students who came from the most rigid anti-gay homes were the most likely to reveal repressed homosexual attraction. This explains why some religious leaders who frequently denounce homosexuality, such as the Reverend Ted Haggard, are later discovered to be engaging in secret homosexual relations, Ryan said. These are people who are at war with themselves, and they are turning this internal conflict outward. And now a look at a couple of articles from the Talking Point section of the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Zimmerman, Can He Get a Fair Trial? Finally, a victory for social justice, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. Florida Special Prosecutor Angela Corey's decision last week to charge George Zimmerman with second-degree murder in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in February was long overdue, given the damning circumstances of the case. Zimmerman pursued the unarmed black 17-year-old because he thought Martin was up to no good, and then wound up shooting him in the chest. The local police in Sanford should have arrested Zimmerman on the spot, but decided that he had exercised his right to self-defense under the state's Stand Your Ground law. I would like to say it's a relief that Zimmerman is behind bars, said Jelani Cobb in the DailyBeast.com, but the fact that his arrest took 46 days and only came after a public uproar shows how hard it still is for blacks to get justice in this country. Actually, the case against Zimmerman is stunningly weak, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Under Florida law, second-degree murder requires the killer to have shown depraved indifference to human life. But Prosecutor Corey's affidavit offers no real evidence to refute Zimmerman's story, which is that he fired only when an angry Martin attacked him. A cynic might conclude that she charged Zimmerman with murder just to bask in the mob's adulation, knowing she's likely to lose the case at trial. Zimmerman might even be convicted, said Mark Hemingway in WeeklyStandard.com, especially given the media's poisoning of the jury pool with its bias. As this story turned into a national cause célèbre, the media edited Zimmerman's 9/11 call to make him sound like a racist and ignored photographic evidence of Zimmerman's own injuries. So how does he get a fair trial? The prosecutor's affidavit may be short on detail, said David French in NationalReview.com, but what's there is enough to vindicate those who call for Zimmerman's arrest. Martin told his girlfriend on a cell phone call that he was going to run away from a guy pursuing him. The screams of help on the 9/11 tape, the prosecutor says, belong to Martin. If evidence indicates that Zimmerman initiated the confrontation, as the prosecutor suggests, no jury will let him off. With so much racial politics tied to the case, said George Jonas in NationalPost.com, a fair trial is one thing Zimmerman isn't going to get. But to have no trial at all in this explosive case would be unfair to Trayvon Martin and his family, and perhaps unfair to justice, too. And now a couple of smaller items as we reach the end of our program this week. In the course of the last decade, there have been 4,428 changes to the federal tax code, or more than one per day. As a result of the code's growing complexity, Americans spent a total of 7.64 billion hours in 2010 negotiating tax-related paperwork, more than twice the working time of all the elementary school teachers in the U.S. The number of fatal car crashes is 6% higher than average on tax filing day, according to a new study of 30 years of accident research. Researchers blame distraction in stressed-out drivers. The high school prom has become an expensive milestone. Between the dress, flowers, a limo, and hairstyling, the average family of a teenager is expected to lay out $1,078 on prom this year, and that is up from $807 just last year. For every U.S. soldier killed on the battlefield this year, about 25 veterans commit suicide. About 6,500 veteran suicides are reported every year, more than the total number of soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And since George H.W. Bush was elected in 1988, every president has been a graduate of either Harvard or Yale. If Mitt Romney takes on Barack Obama in November, it will be Harvard versus Harvard, and the streak will continue. 8 Harvard grads have served as president so far. And now we'll take a look at our poll watch for this week. 50% of Americans say the federal income taxes they pay are just about right, while 45% say their taxes are too high. 68% say the current tax system benefits the rich and is unfair to average workers. And 68% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the National Rifle Association. But 91% say background checks should be required before a firearm is sold, with 6% wanting few or no restrictions on gun ownership. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.